From the Sky News Centre at 6, a man's been sentenced to a minimum of 28 years in jail for murder following an attack on a fellow passenger on a train in Surrey. 36-year-old Darren Pensil stabbed Lee Pomeroy 18 times in January. Outside the Old Bailey, following the sentencing, DCI Sam Blackburn, who led the investigation, read a statement beside members of Mr. Pomeroy's family.
This was a case where a brief argument resulted in a moment of shocking violence that ended with the death of an adored father, husband, son and brother.
It's been decided no action will be taken against four police officers after the death of a man in Exeter in 2012 who was restrained while in custody. Misconduct proceedings were dropped after it was decided they wouldn't get a fair hearing. Decisions on two other officers are still outstanding. Police say two women have been taken to hospital in Warwickshire after reports they were attacked by a dog. The force says they have injuries on their hands and legs after the incident in Bulkington. Thomas Cook is in advanced discussions over a deal which would effectively see its package holiday arm taken over. The firm confirmed it's in talks about a £750 million cash injection with Chinese investors. Shares finished the day down 60%. And Leeds Bradford Airport is open again after a drone sighting caused officials to shut the runway this lunchtime. Police say they are investigating. That's the latest. I'm Anna Bates.
The Centre for Fine Print Research at UWE Bristol have been awarded a grant of £7.7 million to increase internationally acclaimed empirical investigation into the artistic, historical and industrial significance of creative print practices, processes and technologies. Our vision is to solve real-world problems, transforming ideas into solutions that meet the needs of a changing society. We're looking to recruit associate professors, early to mid-career researchers, artist and designer-maker fellowships, administrative, management and technical roles. Successful candidates will start in the autumn and will work in state-of-the-art labs across our key areas of fine art, printmaking, product design, robotics, electronics, engineering, software manufacturing, materials science and nanotechnology. Please register for the recruitment open day at Bower Ashton Campus on Thursday, 18th of July from 3 to 6pm by emailing cfprinfo@ue.ac.uk.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is European Elections Brexit Party candidate Anne Tarr. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Imran Khan in Pakistan takes an interview with an opposition leader off the air in mid-sentence and closes down three private television stations this week. Plus, Jeffrey Epstein, or Epstein, a friend of Prince Andrew, is arrested for child trafficking in the US. And the resignation of British ambassador in the US, also Sir Kim Darroch, Boris, is blamed. But should the real story be how such memos can find themselves onto the front page of a national newspaper? And why? And Turkey takes its first shipment of S-400 anti-aircraft missiles from Russia. The Americans reply by threatening to cancel sales of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter to Turkey. At £70 million a pop and with a terrible record for unreliability, can Britain please cancel ours too? And the Venezuelan ambassador to London, speaking in Bristol last Friday evening, we carried her speech and those of the Cuban and Nicaraguan ambassadors live, but we got cut off. We hear the end of the speech about the Monroe Doctrine. And the concept of South America just as North America's backyard. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 and dry. This weekend, highs around 24 Celsius, light clouds with sunny spells. Next week, highs staying up around 24, sunnier at the beginning of the week, showers and thunderstorms possible towards the end of this week, next week. Next weekend, the 20th and 21st of July, highs around 27 Celsius, showers and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. But a little bit of showers next weekend, not this weekend. Make the most of the good weather. Joining me to review this week's news is European elections Brexit Party candidate Anne Tarr. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the Politics Show again.
Tony. Good to be here.
Just to say thanks ever so much for stepping in, because we did plan to have the senior Conservative in the city, Jeff Gollop, come, but he's put his back out. That's what he said, and so you managed to come along at the last minute. Thanks very much for doing that. In a way, I suppose the Brexit Party's doing this a lot. The Conservatives are retreating from wanting to make public comments about things. I mean, it's actually become very difficult to get Tories to come in. Mark Weston, who's the Tory leader, won't come on this programme anymore. But the Brexit Party are sort of taking their place, not only in terms of the hearts and minds of voters, but also in the media.
Yeah, I think that's true. When you look at some of the policies which the Brexit Party have announced, you can see that we're making up that loss which we've seen in the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party have been so caught up in Brexit and their own leadership elections, they've forgotten about the regions. They've forgotten about the issues that relate to Bristol and to Liverpool and to Leeds and Manchester and so on, the appalling traffic congestion we have, the loss of control of the streets with law and order. And there's a complete policy gap.
Isn't there, Martin Summers, a bit of a paralysis here in that because the Conservative Party, and politicians generally, I wouldn't put you in this category, but they're supremely ambitious and they want to know what's going to happen, what the line has to be before they'll speak out in public. And that this is a bit of a dangerous time for them, because if they say the wrong thing, then if they're, for example, on Brexit, if they're starting to say, well, actually, we need a second referendum or something like that, which is the wrong thing, supposedly, in the Tory party, then the hierarchy will never speak to them again, and their promotions of prospects for promotion are forever blasted.
Well, I think at certain times and places, that's inevitably true. I mean, you know, parties are based around a certain amount of loyalty. I wouldn't include Jeff Gollop in any of this because he's always been a very independent-minded person, and I'm quite sure if he's got a good reason for not coming, that's his reason. Mark Weston has been on this show quite a long, many times over the years. If he doesn't want to say anything at the moment, it's probably for the reasons you're suggesting. I mean, basically, I remember when he wasn't quite sure whether he was for or against Brexit, but as soon as it became clear
Boris,
what was happening,
Boris was
he decided which side his bread was buttered on, but then that's just him.
We're also joined by Sally Bear. Is that right pronunciation, Sally?
Yeah, you're the first person ever to get that right.
Good God, amazing. You're a local health writer and
campaigner against 5G. Oh, and nutritional therapist.
Why 5G? Why has this got your goat?
Oh, wow. Well, anyone who has read about the actual scientific evidence about the health effects of 5G and the potential catastrophic consequences for the environment and wildlife, I'm sure will feel the same that I do.
But isn't this another sort of Project Fear, you know, fake news? What evidence have you got that it's in any way dangerous? I mean, 4G, 3G, I mean, we don't have sort of people walking around with three or four heads yet, do we?
We have a cancer epidemic and an epidemic of neurological problems and massively growing health issues amongst young people and a long list of health issues that can be traced back to 4G and 3G and Wi-Fi. What's happened with 5G is it's crossed a line. There are so many scientists bringing out so many studies to show that the electromagnetic radiation and radio frequency microwave radiation are a serious health issue. We're now realizing that the existing electromagnetic radiation we have is bad enough, but this is going to be exponentially worse.
Oh dear. Well, we think that we need to have a bit of balance, really. Let's get the industry into the studio. People who are doing this, making lots and lots and lots of money out of it, to come in. For example, we've got Bristol Smart Cities, which is a whole sort of project which is designed to try and get smart the Internet of Things into our homes. And Freya Lockwood, she couldn't make it. She said she might be able to do it another week. And then I spoke to Bristol Is Open, which is also a research project which is looking at technologies related to 5G. Julie Snell is the chief executive. She's massively enthusiastic about 5G. She's done gushing interviews and reports about how wonderful it will be. She, though, over the 2 weeks that it's being introduced in Bristol, has taken annual leave. So she's not around to talk, which is a great pity, and no one else there can say anything. So again, I'll keep trying to get one of these people on to talk about 5G. Then, of course, the people who are going to make the most money out of this is Vodafone, Sally. And somebody called James Hope is their head of networks. Vodafone are doing no press interviews at all. But I did track down an interview that James Hope did a few months ago about 5G, where he's asked, what is 5G? So why is this so necessary, this technology? And I'll ask you, after we've heard from him, to say what you think.
Essentially, 5G is a technology that allows us to download and upload things a lot quicker. In fact, probably four times the speed of 4G that we currently receive today. 5G also gives us super quick latency. So when we're applying that to maybe gaming on the move, we won't see much buffering and it will be a better experience all around. There's a massive benefit from 5G, not only about the quicker download speeds and the super quick latency, but also, you know, in terms of the way in which we go about our daily business. For example, here at the airport, if you think about how people get to the airport, the flow of traffic in and out of the airport, being able to understand congestion into the airport, being able to understand how people move around the airport and how we can reduce queuing, how we can enable smart baggage, smart vehicles around the airport, and also things like building security and surveillance. 5G and future technologies can really enhance us in these kind of areas.
So that was James Hope. He's head of networks at Vodafone, who have got the contract for Bristol. They switched it all on apparently last Wednesday, but they don't want to talk about it, even though, of course, they're the ones that are making the money, Sally.
Well, my flippant answer to having less queuing and less congestion is that 5G will kill everyone, so there's going to be less people. My more serious answer, although I'm not entirely joking when I say that, the more serious answer is, first of all, I'd like to hear a bit more explanation about how that is going to cause less congestion and less queuing, because supposing everyone does live, there's still going to be as many people flying, especially with the airport expansions.
Well, I'm not sure he made it clear, really, why traffic jams coming into airports are going to be sorted out and you're going to be able to manoeuvre around them via 5G. Is there going to be a 5G drone come and pick you up and take you over the top of the jam?
Who knows, but is it worth it? You have to have benefits outweighing the cost. And anyone who wants to know what 5G actually means, I mean, first of all, how is more gaming on the move beneficial? I mean, that's not a benefit, it's an outcome. And it's really debatable about whether that's a benefit. Secondly, everybody who wants to know what 5G is and whether they, when I say they, I mean the people who stand to benefit financially, know themselves what the outcome of 5G is. They don't. Watch the video of Tom Wheeler, head of the FCC in America, who's one of the major figures pushing this, and one of Donald Trump's main men. Watch the video about him talking about 5G. He actually says, if anyone tells you that they know what 5G actually is going to mean in terms of outcomes, run for the hills, because we have no idea. It's all unknown. That's what he says. This is entirely about money, and the PR and brochuring about some kind of vague wishy-washy idea about this being about smart tech being green tech is 100% false, and anyone who falls for that needs to take a really good look about what it actually means.
One of the best arguments I've heard is that actually one of the things we really need is fibre that comes into our homes, and it takes much, much less energy to get the data around than pumping this out through some wireless network, which goes into hundreds of people's houses that don't use it or don't want it.
Right, and we're all being mandatorily exposed to this. It is an environmental pollutant, putting it in the air. If people want these incredibly fast connections for whatever reason, then, yeah, sure, cabled is much safer. In fact, there's a group called SafeG who are all about cabling everything. So why are they subjecting all of us, including children and pregnant women, who are more susceptible to this? Most of us don't want it. Those who want it, fine, get it cabled then.
Martin Summers, he snuck in there, did James Hope from Vodafone, a little thing about surveillance at the end, didn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, that's just boilerplate for what he means is you're not going to have your pocket picked at the airport. I mean, obviously, more cynical people will say, "Well, we're surveyed enough as it is." But then, you know, that's just the way in which language is used.
But I mean, what he's saying there effectively is that not only will people who like to keep an eye on people, whatever it is, the police, the government, private industry, know much more about where you are, what your movements, what you're doing, but this whole network itself is potentially hackable. I mean, we've heard that worries about Huawei, haven't we?
Well, I think what happened with Edward Snowden, of course, he was a subcontractor to the NSA, and he had security clearance, and he went in there with an MP3 and stole the crown jewels of US surveillance, and he's ended up in Russia with that MP3.
Martin, I think you mean a memory stick, don't you? Well, MP3 is right. This program, right. The podcast download.
The point I'm making about all this surveillance is, if somebody else can hack him from the other side, then all the work you've done surveying what you're surveying is then in the hands of your enemies. Hezbollah a few years ago in Lebanon, after Rafiq Hariri was assassinated, they were blamed for it, and they gave a press conference in Beirut, said, "We don't really want to give too much away, and we don't really want to do this, but we're going to show you the video feed from the Israeli drone which fired the missile that killed him, because we've hacked into the Israeli system." So the Israelis have got massive surveillance systems. They're probably the leaders in the world of this kind of thing. Of course, the other thing, the Hezbollah just say, "Right, we'll have all of that. Thank you." That's how it works.
Julie Snell, hope to have her on this programme once she gets back from holiday, from Bristol is open. Her background is working for BT, which of course is one of the networks, so it doesn't sound like she's necessarily going to be rooting for the public. Sounds like she's more of an industry person. But so she's a former BT employee for several years, and also an interior designer. I mean, it doesn't sound like necessarily the sort of person who's going to be looking after public interests.
Well, of course not. That's a very serious conflict of interest, isn't it? Is she claiming to be doing something in the public interest? I mean, you can't do something that's purportedly in the public interest unless you're looking at the science, which is indisputable, that shows this is a serious health hazard. That is not working for the public interest. This is not going to make people richer or do anything about the rich and poor divide. This is going to make telecoms a lot of money.
Yes, Vodafone. Strange though that they don't want to come on. They have given sent me a statement which I'll read out in a minute. But Sally, just tell us about your petition and some of the evidence that backs it up.
Some of the evidence is two very large recent studies that were done last year, both on rats whose disease patterns are 97% similar to ours, which is why they're used. So one was a huge multi-million dollar study from the US Department of Toxicology. And they found that if they exposed rats to mobile radiation, they had significantly more heart and brain tumours. And this study, the 15 physicians were called in to verify it, and they all said there was clear evidence there is a link between mobile radiation and cancer. But then a huge PR assault was done on it, and the FDA said, yes, but the amounts were sort of short bursts of high radiation, so that doesn't count. It doesn't show anything about humans in real life. But however, that's completely untrue, because at the same time, a huge Italian study looked at replicated what happens with humans with the sort of, you know, lower level Wi-Fi and mobile radiation over a long period of time. So they made the conditions similar to how it is for humans, and got the exact same result. And then at the same time last year, there's this common misconception that brain tumours are decreasing. But if you tease out the actual brain tumours that are linked with mobile radiation, which is called glioma, and it's a very aggressive kind, which you can't survive, those were the kind that the rats got. Those have doubled in the last 20 years. And in young people, it's one of the fastest growing forms of cancer. They can't necessarily prove that that's caused by mobile radiation, but obviously we have to look at that in the context of the rat studies. And then there are 2,000 peer-reviewed studies which all show harmful bio effects, and there's a load of studies that show harmful bio effects on all living things.
Have the council been listening to you here in Bristol?
Some of the councillors have been listening. So I went to the Green councillors and had a meeting with them, and they were concerned. But there is more people in the Green Party to deal with, and they have to take their time. Quite rightly, they have to take their time looking at everything and considering it. So I'd say they are considering. Lib Dems are definitely listening. In some areas. There's a couple of Lib Dem councillors in Bristol who were at Marvin Rees's question time last night, which was a sort of... I didn't go, but one of my co-campaigners went, and I just had an update from her last night. But there were eight 5G campaigners there asking questions and being fobbed off by the Public Health England representative there, who was saying, we've been studying this and it's perfectly safe. But the Public Health England studies don't take into account the 2,000 plus, it's actually up to 25,000 studies that show harmful effects from electromagnetic radiation. They talk about studies, their information is 20 years out of date. It talks about thermal effects, which are just not the point.
Okay, who does the regulation? Who is supposed to regulate this?
Well, ICNIRP, which is the International Commission for Non-Ionising Radiation Protection, which you would think would be a body which protects us from non-ionising radiation protection, but they're an industry loyal body made up of self-selected members who don't declare their funding and have been accused in the Journal of Oncology of a very serious conflict of interest. They have members within the World Health Organization and are also linked with Public Health England. So none of these bodies can be trusted. They're all using information that's 20 years out of date, and the hundreds of scientists who are appealing urgently for them to update their guidelines to incorporate the actual evidence. They're ignoring it and they're not listening.
Okay, so what the Vodafone people sent me is from an anonymous Vodafone UK spokesperson. Wonder when someone sends it anonymously, I do wonder, is this because there may be some sort of legal challenge afterwards and that they might be legally responsible for people's illnesses? Anyway, let me just finish this. Yeah, the radio frequencies used for 5G in the UK are similar to the ones currently used for 4G, where 4G uses frequencies between 800 megahertz and 2.6 gigahertz. 5G uses frequencies between 3.4 gigahertz and 3.6 gigahertz. Well, that's a little bit more, isn't it? Mm. In comparison, your television transmission uses frequencies of up to 806 megahertz, and Wi-Fi is between 2 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. In fact, 5G spectrum has been used for many years in the UK, just not by the mobile operators. We follow all guidelines laid out in the Code of Best Practice for consulting and communicating with local authorities and communities. In addition, we carefully design our sites so that the impact of any changes, including swapping 4G antenna situated on a mast for a 5G one, is kept to a minimum. These alterations do not require operators to inform the local authorities. Also, all our sites are designed and operated in accordance with the International Commission of Non-Ionising Radiation Protection, as we just heard, an industry body. ICNIRP guidelines. For further information on 5G and health, you can find that at themediacentre.vodafone.co.uk/5G. And let's hear again then from the boss at Vodafone, the people who are making all the money out of this, or most of it anyway, James Hope, who is not doing any media interviews at all, I was told today, but here's one he did a few months ago. And here he talks about whereabouts it is in Manchester, where it's already been rolled out. I imagine something similar going on here in Bristol, as it's supposed to have rolled out last week.
We announced last year that we were going to launch 5G in seven regions within the UK, Manchester being one of them. Obviously in the northwest we have Liverpool's in there as well, but in Manchester especially, because we did the first 5G holographic call last year. We've also just started working on the new digital innovation hub at the Landing in Media City, which is really cool. And we thought, you know, where better place to start? We've got 5G here at the airport. Manchester is the first UK airport to have 5G, so it was just our next phase of commitment towards the northwest. So in Manchester, we have our trial polygon. We have a trial polygon, an area in the city centre. We also have a big hub in Windsor, which we've got 5G live on, and now the airport. So what we'll do is we'll slowly grow out of the existing areas in the city centre, grow out and grow out and grow out, and we'll try to emulate where we started with our 4G coverage. But it will take some time, but that's the aim. We fully anticipate there to be handsets on the market this year, this half of this year. So when we get the handsets in there and the 5G network is available, consumers will be able to use and experience 5G for real.
That's James Hope, head of networks at Vodafone, who's not doing any press interviews, which is apparently, Sally, why he refused to come in today to discuss this with you.
I mean, they must be rattled. First of all, they keep claiming, because whenever people comment on the on their YouTube videos, there's a YouTube video which either Vodafone or EE, I can't remember, but you know, hundreds of thumbs down, and all the comments had been disabled, and people are sort of bombarding their Facebook pages with messages saying, you know, this is harmful to health, and then they wheel out these, oh, but we're only rolling it out at lower frequencies. Well, first of all, we have thousands of studies to show that the lower frequencies are harmful. Secondly, we have thousands of studies to show that the emissions below the accepted guidelines are harmful. Thirdly, the UK and US guidelines are unbelievably high compared with in other cities. And fourthly, if you read that statement that you read up before from Vodafone or whatever it is, it sounds reassuring, but if you actually read it, it means absolutely nothing whatsoever. It's really carefully worded. It says things like, we've been studying microwave radiation for 50 years.
Well, yes, that's right.
They don't actually say anything.
Microwaves really started in World War II with radar. And I noticed, looking at the frequencies and the power, is that the 5G networks are actually higher frequencies than radar and higher power than radar. So since we know that radar signals, and people were injured in the Second World War, they didn't tell anybody about it because they were fighting a war. Through radar signals, we're now dealing with something which is even more powerful, even where we know that am higher frequency, even though we know it's harmful. Anyway, look, Sally, if you could just wind up by telling us how to find the... Oh, hang on. Before, I should let you comment on this, Anne. What do you make of it?
I find it quite interesting because it's clear that this is coming out when there's no real demand for it. But what we do see a great demand for in the country is decent Wi-Fi coverage and decent broadband coverage. And if you're living in the country, you are cut off from the from the network.
Oh, so is
and this
Portishead,
is not going to help.
Is Portishead the country? I suppose it is, really.
Well, Portishead's got appalling broadband in some areas, but overall it's far, far worse than Bristol, but I'm not going to get onto that. But it's really when you go into the real, into what I call the real countryside, where you can't get any signal whatsoever. And to talk about introducing 5G with the enormous cost that's going to be at a time when we haven't even got functional phone coverage across the whole of the UK, I just think is reckless. I can't see the point of it.
And what about regulation? Because if we were to leave the European Union, I almost hesitate to say this, on the 31st of October, if that was to happen, and Britain was to be in charge of regulating this rather than the EU, would it make any difference? I would suggest to you it probably won't.
Well, the EU is obviously a big proponent of 5G, isn't it? It's one of its power grabs because it knows it's being left behind by the US mainly, but also the Far East, on technology. And it sees this as a great opportunity to catch up. So, of course, once we leave the EU, when we leave the EU, we will be in a position to make our own rules and we can look after ourselves. Thank you very much.
That was very confident for saying when we leave. Do you have any inside information?
I wish.
Anyway, look, Sally, could you just tell us where we can find your petition and where people can find out a little bit more about 5G from your point of view, given that the Bristol Smart Cities, Bristol is open and Vodafone have not managed to make it here today?
Yeah, thank you, Tony. So Facebook pages, Halt 5G in the Southwest and Bristol Residents Against 5G. We have loads of resources on there, lots of studies, videos, fantastic videos such as 5G in 5 minutes, amazing video from Raymond Broomhall in Australia, who has been winning cases all over the place. He's just had, you know, he talks about getting 900 masks removed and 1,600 more stopped because a load of doctors and lawyers got real narky when they discovered those masks were going near their neighbourhoods. He says, you know, doctors tend to get very narky when they find out a mask is going to be near them. Think about that for a minute, Public Health England. The petition is pause Bristol's 5G rollout. We've got nearly 6,000 signatures. We'll be definitely, we're definitely entitled now to trigger a full debate, which sounds great, but it's actually only 20 minutes, but that'll be in September. So please sign it and share. I say share it with one friend with a Bristol postcode or a handful of friends, but rather than putting it on your Facebook pages, which people tend to ignore, I think it's a really good idea to get one or two trusted friends to sign it. And it's doing really well. It's a really active petition. There are thousands of people who do not want this technology and are horrified and feel violated looking into legal action.
So you're a Luddite?
No, I'm not a Luddite. As I've said, we want safe tech, and totally agree. But you know, better connectivity for others, and you can have a safe version of Wi-Fi in your house if you use DLAN plugs and plug them into your Wi-Fi router. So I have, you know, I have a Wi-Fi router, but the wireless part is disabled, and it's all plugs, and it's perfectly fast.
What do you do? Do you unscrew it and sort of, I don't know, like use a pair of cutters and chop out some component in there? How do you turn off your Wi-Fi?
No, that's what people are going to be doing to the lampposts when they're beaming 5G. No, it's really easy. You just go into a hub and advanced settings and disable it. You have to go into
your provider's thing. So it's actually possible to do. I must admit, when I first had Wi-Fi in my house, I thought, oh, this isn't, I don't like it. Actually, you can feel it. Can kind of feel it in the air. I turned it off. Martin Summers. So thanks, Sally. That's brilliant. Yeah. Martin, what Sally there is saying is slightly serious, isn't it, over the mobile phone masts and people taking direct action if they're not listened to over these health issues. I know in Belfast, for example, the IRA went in and actually angle grinded off masts, didn't they, when they first started arriving, and they said that was because the locals didn't want them there. That was back in the 90s.
Yeah, but what you're coming back to is what you mentioned, surveillance earlier. They were very concerned about surveillance, so obviously they disabled everything which they thought was surveying people, because it's part of what they were up for, and that's what happened. And of course the Iraqi resistance realised years ago that the way to fight the Americans is just not use electronic components at all. Same with the Taliban. They just rely on word of mouth, and they don't use any electronics, because if you're using electronics, like Dudayev used in Chechnya, he was picking up the phone to speak to Yeltsin, and it was only satellite phones at that stage, and then a missile hit him. Because they knew where he was.
The missile was actually designed to home in on his phone.
So
blow him up.
All guerrilla forces all over the world are very well aware. You've got to hack into their stuff, but make sure you're invisible by not having an electronic stuff of your own.
Fascinating. Anyway, Sally Bear, thanks very much for joining us. I'll put some links up to your stuff on our show page, and also, of course, to Vodafone, their press page, their anonymous press page, to Bristol is Open, and also to Bristol Smart City. Anyway, there's this big debate raging, apparently, about Brexit, and we've got two contenders to be Prime Minister. The first one is Boris Johnson, and he thinks that unless they get it right, the Tory party could be finished.
We are facing an existential crisis as a party, and indeed as a political class, if I may say so, as representatives of the people. We asked the people whether they wanted to leave the European Union. It was right to ask the people after 45 years whether they wanted to stay in an entity that had so radically changed its ambitions, that had federalised, that had become a very, very different proposition, a federal political unit. That question was right to pose to the British people, because it goes to their identity, their sense of their future, their destiny, their potential, everything they want to do. The British people returned a very clear answer. And considering the forces that were ranged against them on the other side of the argument, it was really extraordinary. They voted, 17.4 million people voted to leave. It was a clear, clear majority for leave. The MPs acknowledged that, and they voted, MPs themselves voted overwhelmingly to trigger Article 50 and to come out of the EU. And now we're in a state where MPs seem still to be refusing to enact the mandate of the people. And that is why my party, our great party, is languishing in the polls. It's why Labour is on, 18%? You know, with heroic incompetence, Corbyn has managed to do even worse than us. It's quite extraordinary. And the very simple reason for that, the main parties are not getting on and delivering the will of the people. If we get on and do Brexit, then we will spike the guns of the Brexit Party and the Liberal Democrats, both of whom are prospering at our expense because of our failure to get this done. And I think...
Well, there he's interrupted by the audience. I mean, a big round of applause. There's Boris. This was from last week, not this week. And he then went on to talk about accusations that he'd made lots and lots of gaffes when he was Foreign Secretary.
He'll now be interviewed by Hannah Vaughan Jones from CNN, who's the moderator today.
Boris Johnson, as Foreign Secretary...
Yes.
Intelligence information was held back from you due to concerns over your discipline. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's not true, but I obviously can't comment any further on intelligence matters.
It seems the It seems reports suggest that the order itself came from Theresa May over fears that you couldn't be trusted.
I'm sure that the Prime Minister will not comment on intelligence matters either, so I'm extremely dubious about the provenance of this story.
But were you aware at the time that perhaps some sensitive information was being held back from you?
Look, it's not true and I don't comment on intelligence matters.
So you deny it altogether?
I do.
OK, have you made any gaffes in your time in politics that would concern people?
Yes, I have, and I'm proud of many of them, because the important point about gaffes is that very often, and some of them go, some of them obviously I regret and I've apologised for, but very often a gaffe turns out to be the round unvarnished... When people say that you're making a gaffe, what you're really doing is saying something that is true and necessary, and
but it's also potentially a security risk.
Well, again, sorry, if that's going back to that question, I thought I don't comment on intelligence matters, and the story that you've adverted to is not true.
Well, that's an interesting one, Martin, isn't it? Particularly with this Iranian, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. He did say some... What he seems to be implying there is sometimes when Boris does a gaffe, he's actually just letting the truth slip out.
Well, I mean, there's obviously a variety of gaffes that he's done, and some are worse than others, you know. And some of it is, you know, is what they call dog whistling, you know, the stuff about burkas looking like letterboxes. He's kind of apologised, but he didn't really apologise because he knows that's what the punters want to hear, or the punters that are going to vote for him want to hear. So in actual fact, he's basically, you know, he's actually quite a calculated character. I can't remember who said it the other day. He saw him do a speech some years ago where he made loads of so-called gaffes, and then he saw him do exactly the same speech with the same gaffes to a different audience two weeks later. So you've got a fairly calculated character. That's what Max Hastings, his boss at the Telegraph, said. People who know him know that he's not nearly as much of a bumbling fool as he projects. There's actually a bit of manipulation going on there.
And did you get anything from Boris's character from what he said there in those two lectures? So, firstly, one looking at his thinking potentially the end of the Tory party, the other one about gaffes?
Well, I think there are two things which really struck me. Firstly, the fact that Theresa May didn't trust him. I don't think there's any indication on Boris Johnson. I don't think Theresa May trusted anybody in her cabinet, and I think we saw that with some of the Brexit negotiations. But when you look at Boris, I think it's fair to say that he is a very intelligent. I think his history has shown that, and that he can master a brief very quickly, but sometimes he doesn't always do his homework as he should. The challenge is that important in a prime minister? We need a leader rather than a manager. We've seen what happens when we have a manager. We've seen in Theresa May, it's the design. What the country is calling out for is leadership.
This whole business of not telling other members of the cabinet things that they're really supposed to know, Martin, and the Prime Minister and others, you know, some people being told one thing, some people told... This reminds me a bit of the Wilson days when James Callaghan was being briefed by MI5 fully on what was going on in Northern Ireland, but the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, wasn't being told.
Well, also, what he did when he became Prime Minister, Callaghan, is he upgraded Polaris to Trident, but he didn't discuss it with the rest of the Cabinet. There's been an ongoing debate in political science about the growth of prime ministerial government, because in theory, the British Constitution, the Cabinet, are equals, and the Prime Minister is primus inter pares, first among equals, and there's supposed to be collective responsibility for decisions.
But over time,
that's gradually been completely eroded.
What it sounds like is that the intelligence services can control who's in charge by who they tell what's going on. Anyway,
well, it's all about control of information. Of course, if you control the agenda for the cabinet, if they don't know what's going on, then they can't disagree with you. And there's been a gradual aggression of power around. We've got a prime minister in this country who's got more power than a US president. That's not supposed to be the case.
Can I just add something which I think is crucial at the moment? And that is, when you talk to people on the street and when you go out and just communicate, what we're finding is that this complete frustration that nobody's listening to what the general public are saying. And it doesn't matter what walk of life you're in. We heard it just now regarding 5G. We heard it last time I was in here and we were talking about doctors and hospitals and cleanliness and so on. We're not being listened to. And what that is culminating frustrating is the fact that nobody believes what politicians are now telling us, because they're not listening and we don't believe them.
Well, they're telling us
a complete breakdown.
They're telling us there's going to be Brexit on the 31st of October. Both of them, actually.
And I'm pretty clear you don't believe that, Tony.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. We shall see. But maybe they're just going to put it off again. Anyway, it's time to listen to Jeremy Hunt now. And he, this is what I found quite interesting, was when Boris announced that he wanted to have 40,000, or was it 20,000 new police officers. Jeremy Hunt's reaction was actually, no, we shouldn't be spending the money on the police officers. We should be spending a lot of it on drones and tech in order to predict who's going to commit crimes and that sort of thing. And that is a much more effective way to spend the money. So this is, I think, a fascinating aspect to Jeremy Hunt. And he talks about it here as a fourth industrial revolution.
We have in this country the top universities in Europe, some of the very best ones in the world. Add that to all our technology entrepreneurs, the medicines we're being developed here. We have the chance to be the world's next Silicon Valley. And why does that matter? Because in this part of the world, you gave our country the first industrial revolution. That transformed our country.
He's talking in Darlington.
We could be the country that's home to the fourth industrial revolution. Driverless cars, drones, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, all these things that will set us up for the future. And when it comes to those trade negotiations with Europe, mean that they need us every bit as much as we need them. Now, I'm also the son of a naval officer who wants Britain to walk tall in the world. And you know, when I go to other countries, the thing that really strikes you and surprises you is that they have a whole lot more respect for us than we sometimes have for ourselves.
This is the CNN interview with the pair of them and the debate discussion. I just find it a little bit weird, Martin, just that CNN are actually running an American media company are running a debate discussion between the two prime ministerial candidates in Britain. Sounds like Brexit's already happened and the United States have moved in to take over where Brussels left off.
Well, I think it is interesting and significant, yes. I mean, I don't think that would have happened 20 or 30 years ago, for sure.
Well, certainly not even 2 or 3 years ago, maybe. But anyhow, let's have a listen also now to Jeremy Hunt talking about his mission to sink the Corbyn, well, I couldn't call it a battleship, maybe a frigate.
A political promise to you. If I become Prime Minister, I will not take us into a general election until we've got more young people supporting our party. We can't be the party of aspiration unless the most aspirational people in the country are voting for us. Why does that matter? Because that was the reason that Corbyn did so well at the last election. Ignore that, and you ignore a Labour Party led by the most anti-British, anti-Western, ruthless, dangerous, hard-left cabal that we have ever seen in our history. Now, faced with a hard-left populist, ladies and gentlemen, we could choose our own populist, or we could do better. We could choose our own Jeremy. And this is a Jeremy who will win the argument for enterprise, aspiration, social justice. Get this wrong, and there will be no Conservative government, no Brexit, maybe even no Conservative Party. Get it right, and we will deliver Brexit, unite our party, unleash the enormous potential of our amazing country, and send Corbyn packing. Let me show you how. Thank you very much.
On the clapometer, I think he got a slightly louder ovation than Boris
Jeremy
Johnson. Not quite sure.
Okay, so that was Adrian Charles there speaking last week about this. And I actually did a little analysis of the clapping, yes, on my little audio editing program. And Boris Johnson's claps were twice as long as Jeremy Hunt's claps, if that makes any difference. So what we were hearing from Adrian Charles there isn't really quite the whole truth. So anyway, what do you make of that, Anne, what you heard about all this investment in technology to help the police particularly?
Well, if I was a young person thinking who to vote for the next election, I'm not entirely certain I'd be happy with the thought of more surveillance on electronic gadgets, given how much young people love their electronic gadgets, the thought that they could be followed and tracked and everything else. And I can't really see that that's going to help people with the real crime that's happening on the streets, the fact that the police will have more technology at their fingertips. It's not going to help, is it? If you're lying bleeding in the gutter, what's technology going to do for you?
I mean, what he's talking about really is this whole thing of an industrial revolution. He's saying that this is the forefront of technology. Britain is if we're not going to beat the world building steel, certainly not one of the steel plates closing down, but here's somewhere where we could excel as a country.
Well, that's fine, but my understanding of how this new technology is happening, it is happening organically. It's happening from the ground up, and any sensible city who wants to have a technology plan will have a blank sheet of paper and just give people the breathing space to go and develop what they want to go and develop. And I think we're seeing that very successfully in Bristol. In some of the incubator businesses that are coming out of Bristol, they've just been given the license to go out and develop and the space to be able to do it and some help in setting up a company. That's how you work in the 21st century. This just sounds like command and control, and he just sounds so bland, doesn't he?
Martin, Jeremy Hunt there talking about really sinking Corbyn. Basically, that's going to be his main mission. He's going to be very well organised within the Conservative Party to bring back support for the party away from the Brexit Party, and also to concentrate on getting rid of Corbyn.
Well, it's a bit contradictory, the stuff about Corbyn, because he's either so useless that we just have a laugh at him, or we're so terrified of him we've got to poo our pants to stop him. I think it's neither of those things. I think you've got to remember that this isn't a debate for the general public. This is pitched towards the 160,000 members of the Conservative Party, who are generally older, they're generally white, they generally live in the south of England, they generally have fairly conservative views, and they read conservative papers. And that's the sort of thing, if you want to win this little electoral contest that's being held, that's the sort of thing you've got to say. The problem is that when you come to a wider electorate, the wider electorate doesn't necessarily want to hear that. So you've got to say it to win the internal contest. It's the same problem with the primary structure in the US political system. People have to be more extreme to get to become the candidate, and then they have to track to the centre if they're going to try and win over people who are undecided.
Well, do you think he's got any chance of recruiting a load of new young people to the Conservative Party? Because most of them seem to be interested more in things like Extinction Rebellion, which, by the way, on Monday, starting a 5-day campaign here in Bristol, they reckon that they could block Bristol traffic non-stop for more than 5 days. Operation Mushroom, Extinction Rebellion are calling it, and it starts on Monday. So should Jeremy Hunt be down there recruiting?
Well, I think that I think that's a rather unwise tactic for them to adopt, to be honest with you, but I won't go into that because we're not discussing them. I think there's a real problem for the Conservative Party. I mean, Boris Johnson went to Eton, and he's a posh boy. He gets £250,000 a year to write a weekly column in the Telegraph. He's basically the sense of entitlement of these people. I went to Oxford University just before these people, actually, and I used to meet people like them, and they basically think that it's their country and they should run it, and it's just a contest amongst themselves about who it's going to be, and they really don't connect with the rest of the rest of what's going on.
Look, just a minute, you've got to say what you mean about what's wrong with Extinction Rebellion there.
Well,
this is what protest movements have done
for a long time.
5 days they're aiming to close down on and off Bristol traffic.
Right.
There will be mass die-ins in which eco-warriors will play dead in busy areas, symbolising the death of the planet. People can also expect music and dramatic events.
Okay, I'm just saying that, for example, when the attack on Iraq happened in 2003, we'd been working up to we said that if there was an attack on Iraq, we were going to basically blockade the centre of Bristol. And we'd been saying it for several months before the war broke out. And when it did break out, we did it. We actually blocked the whole centre of Bristol. We had thousands of people blocking the centre of Bristol for several hours, but we were prepared for it. We got loads of leaflets and all the queues of people. We went down the queues giving them leaflets saying, this only happens once in a lifetime. We're going to war. We're having a protest today. This is what it's about. And most people were fine with that because they realised. But the problem with this kind of tactic of making ordinary people's lives a bit more problematic is you've got to give them some positive feedback. It can't just be blocking the road. You've got to give them a leaflet at the very least. And I think you've got to judge these tactics very carefully. I say that as an experienced campaigner.
These are radical rebels that want to be arrested, they've said.
Well, if you want to be arrested, you've got to accept being arrested, but that means you've unblocked the road. But, I mean, the blocking roads is a legitimate tactic, but if you overdo it, you just alienate people. Whose road are you blocking? If it's a picket line and you're trying to stop trucks going into a factory, for example, or people who want to work going into work, and all the rows around the miners' strike in 1984 about that, that's one thing. But if you're just blocking people on their way home from work, then you've got to think, well, what are you going to get them on anyway, side by doing?
Antar, you were a candidate in the elections for European elections for the Brexit Party. What do you make of this latest move by Extinction Rebellion trying to close Bristol down next week?
Well, the cynic in me says some of us won't notice any difference because traffic in Bristol is so slow. So, you know, it doesn't really need any help from a bunch of protesters, does it? But I think the real problem with these sort of demonstrations is that it really affects those who are the poorest in society, whether they're poor in time or poor in money. And if you're rushing to try and get your children to school and then go and check on elderly parents later in the day, and the roads are all blocked and it all takes time, this isn't going to happen. What about all the people at home who are waiting for carers to come into them, or waiting for Meals on Wheels to come
around?
That's all going to be
stuck. If you confront them face to face, they'll say, yes, but the planet is dying. We've got to do something.
Okay. Is the planet dying? Is this really necessary? Because we've heard this sort of statement many times, haven't we? I mean, I recall when I was at school, we should have been covered in 3 feet of ice or something, the whole of Bristol, with the next ice age coming in. So we've heard it over and over again. We have a democracy in this country. We have the means to remove from power those we don't like. The correct way to deal with this is through the ballot box, in my opinion, and that's the way we should be doing it. There's nothing wrong with having demonstrations and marches and so on, but 5 days to stopping the traffic in Bristol, stopping people going about their jobs, maybe putting lives at risk during this hot weather, is simply unacceptable, in my opinion.
Okay, well, we had an interview last week with the former Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, where he talked about the idea that I asked him about a United States of Europe, and he said, well, that can never happen because of the veto at the European Union. And I spoke to a local economics graduate, Alan Brown, who, thank you, by the way, Alan, for getting in touch with me. And this is what we love our listeners to do, to say, actually, I don't think that's right, what Ken said. And so here's Alan now explaining why, what he thinks Ken Livingstone said about being able to veto something like a United States of Europe in Brussels is just simply not correct.
One could argue for Eurozone members whether or not you've already got a United States Europe. If you haven't got control of your budget, because that has to be pre-approved by the European Commission, if you haven't control of monetary policy, because the European Central Bank has to approve the issuance of any new currency, and you're borrowing in a currency which is not yours, which is produced by the European Central Bank, and your private banks are dependent on liquidity from the European Central Bank, who can turn it off and on, which they did with Ireland, if they're not following EU diktat, then I don't see how we already haven't got a United States of Europe already.
Oh, that's Alan Brown there, Martin Summers. What do you make of that? Because what he's saying is that actually, in another part of that interview, which is going to be broadcast in dialect next week at midday here on Tuesday, he says, well, actually, the Lisbon Treaty has also replaced that old veto with something called qualified majority voting for quite a lot of the subjects. And he's saying that actually those subjects include things like defence policy, things like that, where there is no veto anymore. So it does look as if Ken wasn't quite on the ball there.
Well, I think there are people who aspire to having a federal Europe. There's no doubt about that. I'm not one of them, but they're out there. The problem has always been, from my, I would suggest objectively, is that the European Union is a shambles. It really can't get its act together to do anything very much, because it is made up of many, many different countries. I used to work in Eastern Europe, and I can tell you now, Hungarians don't agree with Poles,
Latvians don't agree with Lithuanians. Europe itself is not a shambles. It's actually very well organised. You can get around Europe very easily, and everything seems to be quite well organised. Not a shambles.
Well, I'm just saying that in terms
it's here where we got rubbish on the streets.
The European Union, of the size it is, ought to be one of the major players, with the Chinese, the Russians, the Americans, etc. But it's never been able to do that. I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and the European Union was unable to get itself together to come up with proposals about what to do, because there were so many different factors pulling in different directions. the British Foreign Office and the German Foreign Office were completely at odds, for example, over the recognition of Croatia.
Okay, but what Alan's saying there effectively is because they control your budget, really, you know, they control you. Well, if you control the money, surely, you know, its sovereignty is just neither here nor there.
The Maastricht Treaty does, in fact, it's basically designed on German ordo-liberal principles, which is, you know, designed by the Bundesbank and all the rest of it. And the European Central Bank has eventually ended up doing quantitative easing, but it couldn't do it for ages because the Germans insisted that it mustn't.
Isn't it really just all about money and who's got the money?
Well, listen, ultimately, we should be talking about banks like Monte dei Paschi in Italy, which is about to collapse, pulling all the banking system down, and discussing Brexit.
For years, we've had Deutsche Bank actually in a bit of trouble, but they've managed to sort themselves out apparently by sacking.
I've just been reading a very interesting book by Adam Tooze about the whole financial crisis over the last 10 years. He's a historian, but he's written it's a very contemporary book. And in actual fact, the real problem is we've come very, very close to disaster several times, a bit like the nuclear stuff, but we're too busy arguing in the rowing boat to notice that there's a tsunami about to overtake us.
And before we hear from Anne, we'll hear also about the Greek elections, which took place this week. Syriza booted out over there, and here is Kostas Lapavistas on Sky discussing what he thinks went wrong for Syriza. He used to be a Syriza supporter.
I used to be a supporter of Syriza, became a very strong critic, and we broke away, moved away from it, because we predicted what was going to happen, and it did happen. I mean, the Greek electorate has turned in a conservative way. Syriza has suffered a major defeat. The centre-right are back. They've got a straight conservative pro-market program. A lot of the people who led Greece to the disaster it faced in the previous decade are back, often the same families. Nothing has really changed significantly in the country, and Syriza has been soundly defeated. There is a lesson here, if I may say, for this country, particularly for the Labour Party, and those who look forward to transformative politics while remaining in the EU. It's impossible, and Syriza shows that.
So you think that was the mistake, to not stay in the euro?
I have no doubt at all. Syriza basically promised all sorts of things to the Greek people, didn't deliver them, changed completely and became a pro-EU party, and therefore followed policies that were dictated by EU conditions. And that meant very heavy taxes on the middle class, very heavy taxes on small and medium businesses. The people were devastated, the backbone of the Greek economy.
But of course, the counter-argument to that is whether it is possible for a relatively small country like Greece, in the heart of Europe, to operate without being part of European Union.
Perfectly possible. In any case, for Greece, the issue was getting out of the monetary union. What would have happened with the European Union would have been clear in the process. For Britain, it's obviously a case of the European Union. Greece, it was perfectly possible for the country to get out of the monetary union, to find an arrangement that would have allowed its economy to develop in a different way. It chose to do other things. Syriza promised some things and did the opposite, and now they paid the price.
And now they pay the price, Martin. He says there's a warning there for the Labour Party. Yeah. What the Syriza were trying to do to transform the EU was just impossible, and they should have admitted it straight away.
Well, Varoufakis left Syriza because he basically said, you've got to say we're leaving the euro unless you change the conditions that you're imposing on us, the Troika are imposing on them. And if they'd done that, you see, Deutsche Bank was very exposed at that stage. It's all been a lot of what's happened. Private banking debts have been nationalised and socialised. So you're then dealing with governments rather than private bankers.
But they couldn't even get out of the euro, the Greeks. So
we're out of the euro, so that's not an issue for us any more than it is for the Poles, who've still got the zloty.
Anyway, let's hear Anne's view on that economist Kostas Lapavistas has to say there.
Well, I think the key thing is having control of your money, isn't it? And it's one of the greatest things I think that Gordon Brown did, was to stop us joining the euro. So we do have control of our money. We have control of our taxation. Well, we're not reliant on the European Central Bank in terms of setting exchange rates and interest rates in this country. So we haven't ceded sovereignty in those areas. And I think that's absolutely fundamental, because once you've done that, then yes, you are reliant on the European Central Bank. And when we look at the new commissioner for the Central Bank, or president of the Central Bank, I question whether she's going to have the skills necessary, this is Christine Lagarde, whether she's going to have the skills necessary to pilot her way through the choppy waters
ahead. We've got this massive new, we've got 30 seconds left, we've got a massive new government, haven't we? None of them have been elected. Christine Lagarde's a criminal. She should have done a year in jail, but instead she's been put in charge of the euro at the central bank.
She's in good company in being a criminal, isn't she? Because she's not the only one who's just been appointed. If we look at Joseph Borrell, he was done for insider trading and fined substantially as a consequence.
Well, he's interesting because he's actually quite, yeah, but he's quite pro-Iran and quite pro-Russia, so they might see some changes over that. But what annoys me is that no one actually gets a chance to vote for any of these people. Anyway, that's time now for the Murdoch News. No, it's not the Murdoch News anymore, is it? It's the Comcast News at 7, as we take a weekly look at world news after the, and thanks very much to our guests, European this elections Brexit Bristol Party candidate BCFM Anne Tarr and health writer online, Sally Bearcy after the news.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.